The following program is made possible with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Twameva Mata cha Pita Twameva Twameva Bandhu cha Sakha Twameva Twameva Vidya Dravinam Twameva Twameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva.
First election, people came to listen to me barefooted. Next election, 5 years later, they had shoes on. Next election, 5 years later, they came on bicycles. Now, this is a kind of progress that has been taking place, and it has not left any part of the country untouched.
The first thing the Indian government did was to open every village it connected with the road. And suddenly the change began. The villages were no longer isolated. There were buses going to every village. Practically, now there's hardly any village in India which you cannot reach by bus except during monsoons.
Passages to India, a series created by Julian Crandall Hollick. Mahatma Gandhi said India must learn to stand on its own 2 feet if it is to survive. For more than 40 years, the country has fitfully followed the Mahatma's advice. Life has improved for many Indians, but so much more could have been done. Our program is called Swadeshi, the quest for self-reliance.
Ram Devnagar is a small village on the outskirts of the bustling city of Ahmedabad in Gujarat. Gujaratis are famed businessmen all over the world. But these Gujaratis in Ramdevnagar are untouchables, landless and poor. Nandini Joshi, a small, intense woman in her late 40s, bustles out of her ambassador car, opens the trunk, takes out endless bundles of unbleached and unspun wool. Nima Ben and her husband Krishna rush to clear a space for Nandini on the earth in front of their hut. Nima Ben fetches a small wooden box, opens it up to reveal a rudimentary chaka or spinning wheel. She places some of the fluffy gossamer wool over the spindle, starts to pull gently on the single thread of yarn that she draws from the spindle with her left hand. The little spinning wheel whirs happily away like a toy lawnmower.
So they had bought the charkha last time and they have already completed and made all the yarn without my teaching.
Nandini Joshi is a Harvard-trained economist. They wanted her back there to teach. But Nandini says her work is here, trying to put into practice Mahatma Gandhi's ideas for self-reliance, or Swadeshi. Swadeshi means literally of one's own country. It began as a boycott movement against British goods at the turn of the century. For Gandhi and the independence movement, it meant economic self-reliance for the necessities of life. Here in Ramdevnagar, the village carpenter can make 2 or 3 chakas a day out of bamboo. It doesn't cost much. And spinning on a chaka takes no training. Anybody can do it, even if they're illiterate, blind, bedridden, old or young. For just 6 rupees of raw wool, about 40 cents, these villagers are able to generate 80 rupees of yarn that the village weaver will turn into cloth for saris, dhotis or carpets. Before she started spinning, Nima Ben worked digging earth on the construction site. Krishna was the foreman. But there was only work 1 or 2 days a month. They have no land to grow food. So over the past 3 years, they've had to borrow nearly $700 from the moneylender to feed their family. But now Nandini has set in motion something that offers a way out for Nima Ben and Krishna.
It's not that she sells. Mm-hmm. It's not even that she exchanges in lieu of food. But usually what happens, she gives a gift to her daughter-in-law. Like in the other village, the lady sent this cloth to her younger daughter. And the younger daughter's-in-law sent her sugar. Then she sent food to her middle daughter. And the middle daughter-in-law sent her some wheat. Then she sent cloth to her eldest daughter. And the eldest daughter's-in-law sent her some butter.
Within Ramdevnagar, a little self-contained economy is springing up, all from a spinning wheel and 40 cents of raw wool, just as Gandhi would have imagined it. Looking at Nima Ben and Krishna Bai, I have to agree with Nandini.
So far their hands were meaningless, and now all of a sudden they're able to produce such a thing. So this thing means so much more to them than mere money or cloth. It means their freedom. You can see their eyes sparkling, and as soon as they start spinning, they burst into a song.
It's become fashionable to dismiss Mahatma Gandhi's economic ideas. They literally seem to belong to another age, to a pre-industrial civilization. And yet these notions of Swadeshi, of producing one's own goods within India so that India will be self-reliant, Swaraj, these ideas haunt Indians even today. There's always that nagging suspicion he might have been right after all, that a consumer society satisfies artificial desires, that it takes away some of man's dignity and freedom. And dignity and freedom through self-reliance and self-discipline were, according to the Mahatma, the foundations of a truly democratic society.
Swaraj of a people means the sum total of the Swaraj of individuals. Independence must begin at the bottom. Ultimately, it is the individual who is the unit. The end to be sought is human happiness, combined with full mental and moral development. Self-government depends entirely upon our own internal strength, upon our ability to fight against the heaviest odds.
This faith in the individual went hand in hand with Gandhi's belief that the future of India's economy must be, above all, rural and decentralized, to avoid what he called the economic tyrannies of capitalism and the creation of artificial wants. These, he said, would destroy the individual. But Gandhi could already see the writing on the wall. The future leaders of an independent India had very different ideas about the means to achieve these same goals. In October 1945, in a famous exchange of letters with Jawaharlal Nehru, Gandhi set out for the last time his vision of how India should develop once it became independent.
I am convinced that if India is to attain true freedom, and through India the world also, then sooner or later, the fact must be recognized that people will have to live in villages and not in towns, in huts, not in palaces. Crores of people will never be able to live at peace with each other in towns and palaces. They will then have no recourse but to resort to both violence and untruth.
I do not understand why a village should necessarily embody truth and non-violence. A village, normally speaking, is backward intellectually and culturally, and no progress can be made from a backward environment. Narrow-minded people are much more likely to be untruthful and violent.
We can have the vision of that truth and non-violence only in the simplicity of the villages. That simplicity resides in the spinning wheel and what is implied by the spinning wheel. It does not frighten me at all that the world seems to be going in the opposite direction.
It is many years since I read Hind Swaraj, and I have only a vague picture in my mind. But even when I read it 20 or more years ago, it seemed to me completely unreal. In any event, any consideration of these questions must keep present facts, forces, and the human material we have today in view. Otherwise, it will be divorced from reality.
But Nehru and Gandhi never disagreed about the goal of self-reliance or the need to give every Indian the basic necessities of life.
It is obvious enough that they want food. It is obvious enough that they want clothing, that they want shelter, that they want health. They want such things, regardless of the social or economic policies we may have in mind. I suggest that the only policy that we should have in mind is that we have to work not for a few, not for a group, but the whole lot, and to bring them up on an equal basis.
It was the means to achieve that goal that differed so radically. For Nehru had an almost lyrical attachment to socialism.
I see no way of ending the poverty, the vast unemployment, the degradation and the subjection of the Indian people except through socialism. It means ultimately a change in our instincts and habits and desires. In short, it means a new civilization, radically different from the present capitalist order.
The means was centralized planning and the development, often from scratch, of heavy and basic industries, things like electricity, steel, cement and fertilizers. In the 1950s, L.K. Jha was in charge of controlling the country's imports and exports.
The emphasis on heavy industry was largely on account of an effort at self-reliance. The view was taken that the whole process of industrialization means that you have to depend on aid. So if you have your own heavy industry making capital goods, then you don't need to depend on aid, it will be domestic resources.
These temples of the brave new India dot the countryside alongside the bullock cart and the Persian water wheel. And not without cost. The white marble of the Taj Mahal in Agra is badly eroded from the toxic fumes of an oil refinery, sited just 20 miles away to placate a local politician. Today, over 40 years after independence, there's much to be proud of. India has been able to generate much of its own investment. It doesn't depend on anyone for aid, and for many Indians, the changes have been enormous. Rajiv Gupta is entertaining at home. He's hired two of Bombay's best ghazal singers for the evening. Rajiv is in his mid-20s. He works in the family diamond business in Bombay, and business is booming.
Future in business looks very bright as such. I mean, they can keep expanding. You know, once there is no limit here. It's a free society. It's capitalism as such.
India has now overtaken Antwerp and Amsterdam and become the world's largest exporter of polished diamonds. Rajiv Gupta's India is urban, fast-paced, yuppie. Sometimes it seems a totally different country from village and small-town India, where the mass of Indians still live.
There's a lot of expansion taking place in all fields, whether it's high-tech or electronics or computer or, you know, even consumer items as such. And there seems to be a very good demand for most items, you see, and people are putting in a lot of investments. The basic investments are growing.
And then there's Dalbir Singh, who's left a small family farm in Punjab to make a living in Delhi. Dalbir's a taxi driver extraordinaire. He's taken me to the peaks of the Himalayas and back again, and now here to his village near Jalandhar.
I mean, when you were a young man growing up here. How different was the village from what it is now?
There is a tremendous amount of change. There is a standard of living improved. Education has come. People have gone out. Nobody used to go to school. Now practically every family sends their children to school.
Dispensary,
you see, there are visible signs of change. The people living now, not anymore in the mud houses, but there are houses which have been made paka, they are concrete houses, there's a dispensary in the village. The quality of life has improved a great deal from what it was when I was a child.
In many ways, India has been a success story. In 1947, half the population lived below the poverty line. Today, although that population has more than doubled, less than 40% are officially poor, and income distribution is more evenly spread out among social groups in India than in many other developing countries. Growth in the 1980s was spectacular. Let's forget the conspicuous consumption of the affluent, the so-called five-star society of Delhi or Bombay. The urban and small-town middle class and many farmers are now doing quite nicely, thank you. But vast resources were poured into India's development. And the least one can say is that the return on this investment was modest, very modest. And the reality of life for hundreds of millions of Indians who are not members of the new middle class has not really changed that much since independence in 1947. Kanavedawada is a landscape of sand and rock in southwestern Rajasthan, once fertile land fast becoming desert. For 4 years, the monsoon failed here and in much of western India. Beside a metalled road, 100, 150, maybe more villagers are hacking away at a rocky hillside, the men with pickaxes. The women and children collect the earth in shallow wicker baskets that they dump by the roadside.
What's going on here? What are you doing?
This is the famine relief work.
What are they doing? They're clearing the hillside?
ये क्या पहाड़ की सफाई कर रहे हैं पत्थर काटने का?
पत्थर पत्थर काट रहे हैं।
और ये पत्थर कहाँ जाएगा?
ये पत्थर तो मटेरियल
सड़क के। They are cutting down the hills and the stuff which will come out will go for the road making.
And what will you do when you've cut down the hill? Will you try and flatten this for a field or what?
ये साफ करने के बाद
So what, you're going to enlarge the road here or improve it?
We are going to make into a big school field for the games, for the school.
The millions who still live on the land remain at the mercy of the monsoon. Too much rain and their crops rot in the fields. Too little rain, their crops shrivel up. Either way, debt, financial ruin, slipping further into the clutches of the moneylender. 30, even 20 years ago, the failure of the monsoon would have meant hundreds of thousands of deaths through starvation. That no longer happens because successive governments have learnt there are ways of putting food inside people's bellies, even if they don't have the money to buy it. No starvation then. But these villagers are not much better off after 40 years of development. Take Hiro, one of the men toiling here in Kanavedawada under 110 degrees sun. Hiro is small and wiry, head smothered in a red Rajasthani turban, wielding a pickaxe, his feet bare.
And how long have you been doing this work, Hiro?
He's got 15 days.
On this particular site, we have been working for 15 days. इससे पहले कहाँ काम करते थे? इसलिए कि अकाल से काम नहीं इसलिए इधर आए?
पानी नहीं है. अकाल है पानी नहीं है.
No water, so we can't do any work on our lands.
पानी नहीं है.
You had no more money, I suppose, to buy food.
Money, no, paisa bhi nahi.
Because
we have no work at home, we have no money, so we have to come and work in the field like this and earn some money.
How much do you get for working here?
Kitna ban jata hai din mein? Pagar kitne mil jate hai banne se?
Ye 107 rupees din ke.
6 to 7 rupees a day we can make.
Is that enough to feed you and your families?
Usse pura ho jata hai.
Nahi ho jata sab kya kare? Kya
kare? We have no alternative. It's not enough, but what do we do?
So there are days when you go without food.
Nahi pura kya kare?
Jis din kaam nahi hota fir kya karte? Khana bana?
Khana bhi sta. Rest
to karna padega. And they no money, then they no food.
Raisa card bana hua hai.
Look, what's going to happen if the government stops this program? What are you going to do?
Yadi government ye kaam nahi chalayegi to fir kahan se paisa aayega? We either go out somewhere or we don't have any other way of earning money here.
You'll leave this area and go and try and find work elsewhere?
But if there's no alternative, then we have to go out to make some money.
In 1947, these slopes were covered with fruit orchards. They're completely bald now. Not a trace of vegetation. All the trees have been cut down for firewood for cooking. The people can't afford paraffin or biogas. Development has come at a terrible cost to India's environment. Much of its best soil is now hard clay or red laterite, exhausted of the natural wealth by years of overexploitation. India's forest cover has shrunk. Unless something is done soon, the foothills of the Himalayas will one day look exactly like this brown moonscape in Rajasthan. Not what Gandhi had in mind. He believed that man must live in harmony with nature. The peasants here in Kanavedawada know it too.
When was the last time it rained here?
For nearly 3 years, there hardly been any significant rain.
Now, why do you think it hasn't rained?
बारिश क्यों नहीं हुआ आप जानते हैं क्या हुआ हमको क्या मालूम नहीं पता है वी डोंट नो व्हाई बट इट हैजंट रेन्ड
डू यू थिंक इट्स एनीथिंग टू डू विद द लैक ऑफ ट्रीज हियर
नहीं नहीं ऐसा नहीं लगता पर हमारा दुष्काल सो गया ऐसा
वी डोंट नो व्हेदर इट्स बिकॉज़ द ट्री बट देयर इज ऑब्वियसली समथिंग टेरिबल हैपनिंग सो दे नो रेन बैड टाइम्स हैव कम सो दे नो रेन
Is there anything you think you can do to make that rain come?
We don't know what to do. If you pray, even then nothing happens. So what can we do?
Another man thrusts himself forward at the outstretched microphone. Men and women jostle to record their complaints.
What were you going to eat today?
Roti.
Roti.
Dal, roti. Kya koi bhi sabzi. Kadi badi.
Just made roti, dal, or whatever
vegetables you can eat. How long do you have?
Very hard work and they're very little to eat. Work is very tough.
Has anybody died here because of the drought? Because of lack of food?
Aisa koi aisa hai ki koi aadmi bina khaye nahi mila mar gaya bhookh se aisa kuch hua kabhi
kya malum nahi hua
bhookh se nahi
kuch se pet pet bhatte hain
nobody died to kya malum dies nahi
What about your cattle? Have you lost a lot of them?
Achha, pashu mara hai?
Mara hai. Mara hai. Kaafi mara hai.
Lack of food and lack of water.
Kaafi mar gaye hain. Ji mar rahe hain. Kya kare?
They keep their regular diet. There is a very lack of fodder and lack of water.
Main bolo bhai, atla ko. Matlab atla apna baat kare koi hum log nahi hum log.
Aadi jaat pakad ke liye hum
log. Achha ji. Namaskar. Ram Ram.
Ram Ram.
Ram Ram.
30 years ago, The United States regularly sent millions of tons of wheat to prevent Indians from starving to death. In 1985, the United States sent similar aid to Ethiopia. But what few remember is that India also sent food to Ethiopia. In little more than a generation, India has gone from basket case to breadbasket, capable of feeding not just its 825 million people, but other less fortunate countries as well.
Jagjit, this year's harvest, wheat harvest, is it a good one?
Yeah, this year it's a very good crop and a good yield we're expecting. And because the harvesting is mostly done, now it's a threshing time, almost timely.
Six farm workers are threshing wheat on Jagjit Singh Hara's farm here in the heart of the Punjab. Jagjit Singh Hara is a tall, rangy Sikh, dressed in blue jeans and plaid shirt smeared with engine grease. He bends down, picks a handful of heads of wheat, puts one between his teeth, and cracks it.
It will crack when you put it under two. Generally, the farmer, they take out the grain and put it on. If it makes the noise, ready.
All across Punjab, farmers, their wives and children are harvesting and threshing wheat as fast as they can, getting it into storage on the farm or in town. The roads are clogged with huge combine harvesters heading for their next assignment. Tractors drag farm wagons filled to the brim and beyond. Huge jute sacks full of grain sag over and around the wooden walls of the wagon. Giant beer bellies spilling over their belts. Punjab is less than 2% of India's landmass, but it now produces 60% of the country's wheat and rice, thanks to what has come to be known as the Green Revolution. Jagjit's family used to live in what is now Pakistan. In 1947, they had to abandon their farm and flee across the border with just the shirts on their backs. Jagjit was 12 years old when he landed up here near Ludhiana with his family. Today, he owns 85 acres and has a three-bedroom brick house, an outdoor swimming pool.
And when you look back on it, isn't it a fantastic transformation that's taken place in your life?
I can't believe that. In those days, we used to hoe our fields. We used to work in the night time. When we came here in 1951, can you believe that we lived under a banyan tree for 3 years? There was no room, no roof. This is a long story, and when I remember those days and I tell my children, they don't believe me. That no, it's not. Every day from here, it is 12...
Jagjit is a Jat Sikh. Jats are a caste who specialize in farming. They take pride in being good farmers. They're also prepared to take risks and innovate. And that's probably why the Green Revolution took place here and not elsewhere in India. In 1951, when they were given this land in compensation for what they'd lost in Pakistan, Jagjit and his father did something completely revolutionary. They invested all their savings in a tractor. It was the first tractor seen in these parts. All the other farmers used bullocks to plough. Jagjit says there was something about one cannot have a good crop without the feet of the oxen. But Jagjit was convinced machinery was the way of the future.
You see, risk and agriculture, these are the two professions, they go together. One has to have a faith in God. And until Allah you have this kind of thinking, you can never be a success in agriculture. If you don't have a liking or a dedication to a profession, you can never make a success. One thing in Punjab you will see, people have a liking for this profession.
Jagjit drove the tractor till midnight every night that first year. The farm turned a profit. When people outside Punjab talk of the Green Revolution, they mean the introduction of high-yielding seed varieties in the late 60s. But farmers like Jagjit will tell you that the real Green Revolution took place in the 50s, when farmers borrowed from the banks to bring water to their farms. Almost the first thing Jagjit's father did was install two electrically driven tube wells. Then he took the precious water to his fields through thousands of feet of underground piping. When the new seeds were handed out, Punjab struck gold. Yields of wheat and rice tripled, quadrupled, quintupled. But those golden years only lasted until the mid-70s. The cost of the revolution, fertilizers, pesticides, they gradually caught up with yields.
Are the yields still going up?
The big jump was there when we got the new seeds. Now there's an increase of 5%, 6%, very nominal increase is there. Mm-hmm. But even if to maintain that level, whatever the new seed they gave us, it's quite a big challenge to the farmer mm-hmm. because there's a lot of drain on the soil.
Well, is your soil in good health? I mean, it's basically, it's like a invalid who's taken about 400 different types of pills, it would seem.
But to make the soil sick is very easy. But to bring it back to the on the line, it's very, very difficult. And similarly, some of the other...
Jagjit says many farmers have ruined their soils. He doesn't want to use chemicals, so he's using organic methods to keep his soil in good health.
Work, I have planted this. You see the gap?
Yeah.
24 inches lines, then 48 inches gap. My own research.
And, what are you planting there?
This is cucurbits there. Already three crops are out in a year, what single beets? Year. Cucurbits.
Okay.
Muskmelon, so... you can say.
Ah, okay. Well, I wouldn't have guessed that.
That's cucurbits, you know?
Jagjit Singh Hara's neighbor is Mohinder Singh Garhwal. Jagjit says a farmer needs 25 acres minimum to make a living from the land. Mohinder, like the majority of Punjab's 3 million farmers, has considerably less than that. On his 12 acres, Mohinder used to grow rice and wheat and found he couldn't make a living. So he switched to market gardening.
Here... I take 15 to 16 crops in a single year on this 12-acre farm. This, all these crops, now there are about 8 crops standing here. See, this is carrot for seed production. This is cauliflower for seed production. Mm-hmm. This is your sunflower, which is so...
In all, Mohinder grows 15 different crops on those 12 acres. His annual profit is $5,000. Not bad, but it pales besides his neighbor's swimming pool.
And then... You see the sugar cane. Here the intercropping has been done with the cucurbits. This is muskmelon just near to us. So that is a garlic there. So, I mean, so these are...
What's that over there, the white?
That is also carrot for seed production. So now...
For now, Mohinder makes a decent living. But when he dies, his farm will be split in two between his sons. Fragmentation of farms doesn't decrease yields, but it makes farming unprofitable. Mohinder's youngest son doesn't want to stay on the land.
There is no profit in the farming. So I can just earn 3,000 rupees per month when I am in a government service, other facilities. What I can earn here, my father has 12 acres. On and a share, I got six acres in my share.
Mm-hmm.
What will I do in 6 acres? There's not much profit.
Mohinder tried making honey for the big hotels in New Delhi. But he ran smack into a problem that plagues many fruit and vegetable farmers, the almost total absence of any marketing or wholesale network to get the product from the farm to the retailer. One young farmer, Lakhbir Singh, who lives near Gurdaspur, grew lemons because he'd been told there was a big shortage of lemons in urban markets.
Somebody told me to take it to the town, so I... put them in a big bag and took to the town, and even there I found no buyer. So ultimately I had to exchange it with somebody who was selling fry fish. So I got half a kilo of fry fish in return for that. So marketing is one of the major problems that such kind of agriculture produce go waste, and we don't really get any money, and which is a pity.
Lakhbir's angry. He thinks the Green Revolution's a cruel hoax on small farmers like him. He thinks the solution is a food processing plant. Pepsi Cola wants to invest in one right here in Punjab. But the politicians and bureaucrats in Delhi are frightened. Maybe Pepsi will be the thin edge of the multinational wedge. For many Indians, multinationals are synonymous with loss of independence. Maybe Indian companies will build that food processing plant. But then maybe they won't want to. Punjab has a bad reputation now because of the terrorism. I think people blame the Green Revolution for things it never could, was never meant to deliver. It fed India. It created hundreds of thousands of jobs, from tractor repairs to fertilizer sales. But it was by definition a capital-intensive revolution, and that means producing more with less people. Job creation in other areas of the economy couldn't keep pace with the exodus from the land. Jagjit Singh Hara says it's like the proverbial half-filled glass.
Now the pessimist will say half-empty. The optimist will say half-full. It's your own thinking. But whatever we did it, I think our country was in need of food, and we were really food shortage. We produced and we fed the whole nation.
Thank you.
you have to have, you know, indigenize you, the major part of the, any computer. The
hello. Computer. Yes. As in Bombay. Are you 1 second, channel right now. Hello. As in Bombay channel.
Hello. Sudesh Bansal, managing director for Essen Electronics, proudly shows us a new seven-color printer his software division is developing. Essen Electronics is one of India's fledgling computer companies. It has offices in Bombay and a brand new plant here in an industrial estate in Gandhinagar, the capital of Gujarat. In the climatically controlled factory, Indians are assembling personal computers that look like IBM PCs but bear the logo Essen Electronics, made in India. They turn out about 800 a month from this factory. Bansal says they simply can't keep up with demand.
The air conditioning, the power plant.
How much are you growing a year?
We have about 150% growth per year.
Okay.
And we have two more plots bought, which is starting this year. One is the telecommunication and one is the component. Okay, so we cover the whole range of, you know, computer-related hardware.
You must have a problem with sending...
This computer revolution shares many of the advantages and disadvantages of the Green Revolution, and both are a source of national pride. Indians are extremely good at mathematics, and computer programming is a natural fit. Both also are capital-intensive, requiring easy bank credit to get started. That's where the similarity ends. The Green Revolution was homegrown. It epitomizes Swadeshi, the concept of a self-reliant India. But India imports almost all its computer technology. It merely assembles hardware and sticks on a Made in India label.
In India, we feel, you know, the technology development abroad in the computer hardware has been so fast. And India is just picking up now. And there's no need of inventing the wheel again. If there's a technology available, you can straightway take. But we have realized that our strength in India is the software, okay? And we are putting a lot of resources, efforts to see that we develop a software which will be better than the world market.
Vivek Parikh, who founded Essen Electronics in 1978, says that American companies such as Digital, Hewlett-Packard and Texas Instruments have all set up joint ventures in India because of the quality of the labor force. Parikh agrees that the future for India lies in software.
As far as the software is concerned, we are already very competitive because there we don't need the equipment. We need only the manpower and the basic ideas. And that I don't believe India is lacking at all.
Indian technology institutes can't turn out computer specialists fast enough. Starting salaries may be only $250 a month, rising to $1,000 a month after 4 years. But in a country where the average annual wage is just $240, computers represents one way from rags to riches in a very short time. Sometimes it seems that all India under 25 has gone computer crazy. But the use of computers is in fact very limited. Most people can't afford them, and the electricity supply is simply too erratic outside of Bombay or Delhi. The slogan, "A computer in every village," was just that. India's farmers have more immediate and pressing concerns than computers. In computers, as in so many things, India is still a country of potential, not yet of achievement. Perhaps one day we'll all be working on Essen personal computers. But if that's ever going to happen, the computer industry will have to be allowed to import the technology it wants, and invest and grow how it wants, with no big brother controlling every move from Delhi. For almost every other industry, such freedom has been unheard of. Vikhroli is an industrial estate an hour north of Bombay. Here, the Godrej Company make chemicals and boilers. Godrej is a household name in India. The family, who are Parsis from Bombay, own companies producing everything from soap to refrigerators, safes to typewriters.
When we started making our typewriter,
We were told that we should be completely self-reliant. So we said they will not be up to the mark. We do need a little bit of technology, so on. So we wasted a lot of years.
Saurabh Godrej is chairman of the Godrej Group of Companies. Saurabh says self-reliance became an ideological straitjacket that has seriously retarded the country's industrial development.
If you are allowed to import essential things, it only quickens the process. You can do everything on your own, but time doesn't wait. The trouble with India is that we have not been able to keep pace with the advances in the advanced countries.
Nadir Godrej, Saurabh's nephew, is managing director of the chemical division based at Vikhroli. For more than 40 years, the government has insisted India could develop its own industries behind protectionist walls. For Nadir, that spells economic nonsense.
A lot of our raw materials are produced indigenously, but they're much more expensive than imported raw materials.
Well, this is the question. I mean, I learned there's a huge difference.
Yes.
Why the hell don't the government allow you, because presumably there's a big demand for your products, why the hell don't they allow you to import?
Because they think that by keeping these high prices, they'll encourage production in India.
In fact, polyethylene, one of the raw products used by Godrej soaps, costs four times more to buy from an Indian producer than it would if it could be imported. No wonder Godrej and many other Indian companies can't even begin to compete on world markets. Nadia thinks these duties should be eliminated over 10 years. He also wants less government control on investments.
You have to have a license for most investments.
What does that mean practically? If you wanted to build a plant, say, in Gujarat, you could not do it?
Not without government permission. In fact, we have a project to make alpha olefins. It took us 3.5 years to get the government permission.
Nadir Godrej can count himself lucky. Some licenses can be delayed up to 10 years. But that's not the end of Nadir Godrej's troubles. If he has a plant that's running at a loss and he wants to close it, he can't, because by law he cannot fire the workforce, nor can he cut wages. That's illegal as well.
Well, what do you do?
You hope that you can, if you improve productivity, you have to expand. That's the only way you can do it.
So it is, I mean, it is absolutely forbidden to sack a worker?
Yes.
To lay off workers?
Yes, even workers who have sacked for disciplinary reasons, if you don't follow the procedures to the exact detail, they can be reinstated by the courts.
I think India's rulers became obsessed with the means and not the end. They shackled the natural entrepreneurial instincts of Indians, got the state into heavy industries and forgot economic realities. There are over 30 nationalised industries. They're all heavily overmanned, and only one, oil and gas, in fact makes a profit. The state pays huge subsidies to these and scores of private companies who are officially sick and have sought government protection from the bottom line. These subsidies, needless to say, eat up huge amounts of investment capital, something India can ill afford to waste. Ahmedabad is divided into new and old cities by the Sabarmati River. For most of the year, the river is little more than a trickle. On the sandy shore, under the medieval fortifications of the old city wall, live 70,000 people in wood and tarpaulin shacks. For many years, I've been coming to Ahmedabad, staying in a run-down and friendly hotel run by a Goanese family. The hotel garden ends on top of the old city wall. Many times I've gazed down at the end of the day and watched a young girl cradle a baby in an old inner tube suspended between two football posts. Lal Devagar certainly isn't the worst slum or basti in India by a long shot. It's an average basti, and that's why its existence and growth since independence is the most potent indictment of the failure of India's politicians to deliver on those basic needs that Nehru talked about back in 1945. Shelter, a job, health, schooling, and basic human dignity.
This was the first house where the basti started after the bridge was constructed.
Number 786. Now, Amar, why did you and most of the others, why did you come here?
Couldn't you find accommodation elsewhere?
हम मकान खरीद नहीं सकते और मकान के लिए तो यहाँ सिटी में बहुत तकलीफ
किराया ज्यादा
किराया ज्यादा और पगड़ी ज्यादा
20,000 पगड़ी.
Well, most of the people who work here are laboring people. They cannot afford to hire a place in the city because the rents are very high. They have to pay a lump sum which they can't afford to pay. They obviously cannot buy property in the city. So the only alternative for people who work in the city is to live in these kind of bastis.
Amar Saeed's a friendly fellow, 45 years old, married and with two children. He works in the city pulling carts in one of the markets. Most of the people here are hand pullers or street vendors, selling everything from fresh vegetables to kitchen cabinets and stools on the sidewalks. It's the residents of Laldavaga Basti and hundreds of thousands like them who perform all the 1,001 jobs that keep a bustling city like Ahmedabad humming. Amar says most people here earn about 15 to 20 rupees. In terms of earning power, that translates into $10 to $15 a day.
But do people get work every day, or do the long periods of the month when they don't get any work at all?
These people are the people who are doing work in the city.
Barish ka mausam aayega. Barish ke mausam mein to ek din kaam kare, do din kare, char din nahi.
There is work. Work is available. Sometime, give an example, if there's a rain, then we don't have much work. And then you have to sit at home. But normally you get work, but there are also instances people sit 3 days at home and work for 4 days or something like that. But by and large, the work is available.
Laldavaga Basti has corporation electricity and running water. But there's no public school here. Kids go either to an Islamic school, a madrasa, or into the old city to a government school, if they can afford the books. If not, the kids begin working, cleaning houses, running errands and worse. It's little wonder that India's literacy rate never seems to improve.
What about health? I mean, where do you, if somebody falls ill here, a doctor costs money, doesn't he? And medicine costs money. What do you do about that?
There's no government dispensary here. We have to go to the private doctors in the town. It costs money, but what do? When you fall sick, you have to go to a doctor.
Well, exactly. When you fall sick, you should go to a doctor, but what if you don't have the money?
Well, in such case, you have to go to the government-free hospital, which are crowded, but that is the only way you can go there.
Amar and his wife, Noor Anisa, take us on a tour of their section of the Basti. In the middle of the mud lane, a piece of piping and a tap stand almost insolently alone.
Every hour. You drink it as well, you're not worried about illness? No, Nisa, you have no form of sanitation, so where do you go, in the river?
Nadi mein jaate.
They all go to the river.
Does that get into the drinking water?
That's not a drinking water.
But it's not very nice, is it? It's not good.
Your children
sick when they're young because of that?
Well, the children do fall sick. There is often cases of jaundice, there are cases of diarrhea. Waterborne diseases often strike children here.
So sanitation, proper sanitation would be your number one priority.
We've been still fighting. We haven't been able to yet succeed to persuade the government to lay down the sewer lines.
Do you think you have a right to this and they really should do it? You shouldn't have to fight for it. It should be given to you as a right.
Pet tikka to kamata hai, samjho, apne pet laayega aur bachcho ko paale laayega. To itna sara ye kaha se kar sakenge?
Well, we are not talking in terms of
rights, but after all, we have to live here, we have to work here, very poor people. We do need some kind of facilities in which people can exist. These are politicians' talk. When the elections come, they all come here, and that is the time they give big promises that you will get a sewer line, you will get this, you will get that. But once the elections are over and they've got their seats, then they forget.
Given that you're poor and that you live here and none of these high politicians pay any attention to you, is your life a happy one?
Well, you see, given the kind of situation we have been forced into, it's very difficult to perceive happiness or non-happiness. But the way we are, the way we have been forced into, and we can't do anything about, we can't really, we haven't been able to succeed in rising up. So, for the time being in such a situation, you remain happy the way you are. I mean, you would like to make an effort, you would like to rise in mobility, but if you're not allowed to, if you're unable to do it, then what do you? You can't keep crying all the time. You have to have some kind of happiness within your own situations.
I don't know if life will improve for Amar and Noranisa. Unfortunately, I'm certain of one thing. There'll be a lot more people crowded into the Basti. Indian governments have good intentions, but they've completely failed to control India's population. There were 350 million Indians in 1947. Today there are 825 million, and by the year 2000, there'll be more than 1 billion. There'll soon be as many people in the state of Uttar Pradesh as there are in all of the United States.
In 47, we became independent. We felt, people like me, that now this poverty will go away from our country.
Saurabh Godrej, chairman of the Godrej Companies in Bombay. He has every right to feel angry. The population base was already so large in 1947 that just paying lip service to population control means that all that growth has just been marking time. It's all been eaten up by more mouths.
It depresses us that this is something that I'll die before I see prosperity in my country to bring about. And there, it's very simple for me. Why the hell did we not seriously think about controlling the population? There were so many stupid ideas from some communist countries also. The more hands you have, the better, the richer you will be and all that sort of thing. So we have suffered. It took a lot of time to implement it. Then we are a democracy. So the main thing that is galling is that I am as much as an Indian as the one who is wallowing in extreme poverty. So controlling the population alone would achieve a large portion of what I desire.
In the mid-70s, Mrs. Gandhi and her younger son Sanjay suddenly became conscious of the problem and introduced a policy of brutal and crude mandatory sterilization. The policy was a political disaster. It led directly to Mrs. Gandhi's defeat in 1977. Since then, population control has had to be done sotto voce. Yet there's plenty of evidence that poor rural and urban women have got the message. Education and female literacy are working. But the onus is still on the woman. Men are unwilling to lose face and their potency. This is Muni. She's in her 30s and lives on the pavements of Bombay.
How many children do you think is the right size for a family?
Only.
Why do you say two only?
Yeah, it's difficult to manage children these days with the costs going up. So the more the children, the more problematic. Aapko kya lagta hai? Aapne char kyun bole?
In Dubai lives several hundred miles inland on the arid Deccan Plateau, trying to scratch a living from a half acre of land. In Dubai's husband has gone and gotten himself sterilized.
How was your husband convinced to have the operation? Was it the government who convinced him, or was it you? Because that's a radical step to take, isn't it?
Nobody came from outside to tell us. We, both of us decided, took the decision.
And why did you take the decision? Because it would have been too expensive to raise
More kids or what?
Chal suru hoti ki operation karayachi.
Because of the propaganda, everybody knows that after 2 or 3 children, it is better to get operated and to control the number of children. So we decided accordingly. पण मुख्यत्वे म्हणजे आर्थिक कारणासाठी वाटलं तुम्हाला का कसं वाटलं म्हणजे दोन किंवा तीन मुलं बस का अजून का नको.
Swadeshi and Swaraj are values deeply rooted in the Indian psyche. They satisfy national pride. They find a deep resonance within Indian culture. They hold out the eternal promise of a third path, an Indian way between capitalism and communism. And despite appearances, self-reliance has never meant turning one's back on the rest of the world. Self-reliance is also part and parcel of the development dilemma India has always found itself in. I've never believed that the normal rules of Western economics can be applied wholesale to India's condition. IMF-style capital-intensive development across the board would throw hundreds of millions out of work. The political and social consequences would be catastrophic. America, for example, is fed by just 2 million farmers, and they have to be subsidized to the tune of $25 billion a year to keep them economically viable. India has 70 million farmers. You can do the math. There's no universal law that says India can't evolve its own economic model to fit its own circumstances. Maybe something along these lines. High-tech, internationally competitive industries to pay for vital raw materials and technology. Alongside, a labor-intensive economy that respects India's endangered environment and relies on its own resources and traditions. Swaraj and Swadeshi can still be the guiding principle for Indian development, but they have to be rethought, their implications spelled out clearly and coherently, and applied to fight the battles of the future, not the struggles of the past.
Swadeshi, The Quest for Self-Reliance, was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick and Dean Capello. Recording assistants in India were Rana Behel, Celine De Cruz and Kalpana Salunki. The actors were Pradeep Krishan and Akbar Zaheer. The theme and incidental music were composed and performed by Shubha Shankaran. Consultants to this program were Lloyd and Suzanne Rudolph of the University of Chicago and T.N. Madden of the Institute of Economic Growth. For more information about cassette copies of this series, please phone 1-800-854-TAPE during regular business hours. Passages to India is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, and is made possible with major grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Rockefeller Foundation. Support for the national distribution of this program is provided by this and other national public radio member stations and by the NPR Cultural Program Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts and Bramalee Pacific, master developer of Oakland, California's City Center Office Development. I'm Deepika Roy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.